Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
And we're joined now by The Guardian's Gary Young, who has a new book out today, which is called Another Day in the Death of America. He looks at all the gun deaths on a single day among children and teenagers and uses them to reflect on Americanism, gun violence and some other subjects. Welcome, Gary. Welcome to our podcast catacomb.
Thanks for having me.
Our dingy basement. I thought it was really interesting that you said, you know, I mean, you talked about the kind of arbitrariness of the date that you ended up picking, but the cases that you ended up with, what portrait of America did you kind of end up with from them?
Well, if that day was going to be representative, then there were 10 kids who were shot dead that day, children and teens. 7 were black, 2 were Latino, 1 was white. So that day would suggest a disproportionate number of black people, which is true, but it's not that disproportionate. What you wouldn't get are the cases, I think there's one a week on average of a toddler who shoots someone, even themselves, and dies, you know, finds a gun in a mum's handbag or behind the sofa. You don't get that. And what you also don't get in this book is suicide. So on average, 7 children and teens are shot dead every day. Of those, 2 on average will be a suicide, but suicides aren't reported. And so finding the suicide victims and their families is just much more difficult to do in a timely manner. What you do get is a sense of who's likely to get shot, which is basically people who aren't well off. If you're well off, chances are you have parents who will ferry you around. You probably live in an area where there are kind of youth services. You're not out on the street so much. So there's all of that. And then you get this sense of just unluckiness, just the brazen, you know, just the awful Tyler Dunn, who's 11, who's shot by a friend at a sleepover. Now, on the one hand, the friend's father leaves 4 guns loaded, hanging around the house. So there is negligence there. But it's also true that that's probably happening all over the country somewhere. And on this day, Tyler's number comes up. And what you realize is somebody's number's going to come up. That is, if 7 kids are getting shot every day, that it was, you know, in a sense, it was these kids' turn, if you like. And you also get a sense that of why it can be so difficult to rally national sympathy and empathy around most of these victims of gun violence. Of the 10 kids, I would say 6 of them were up to something. Only one of them was up to anything particularly serious. He was in a gang. His godmother said that he had killed people. If I'd picked another day, I would be choosing the victims of Tashawn Anderson in Chicago. But the others were being kids. They were being kids. They were smoking weed. They were hanging out, smuggling girls into their... They were all boys. Smuggling girls into their room. They were doing nothing particularly crazy, but enough that if you were writing about them, you could discard their death as being something that they had coming, if that's what you wanted to do. Maybe they had had some trouble with the law. maybe they lived in an area where there were lots of gangs, and so they could be identified as being gang-related, that there is a way, and America does do this, of dismissing a lot of these deaths. So it ends up that you feel like you're not really talking about children at all. You feel you're talking about monsters, you know.
You mentioned that in your Guardian piece, didn't you, about the way that Tamir Rice was talked about, or the way that Trayvon Martin was talked about, and people sort of say, well, no, he didn't look like a kid. You know, he looked like these pictures that are being used in the media are really... really off-putting. I think the other thing I thought, which I think you wrote about before this, was this idea that what you've done with this book is taken kind of, you know, dog bites man, right? You've taken a story that no longer gets reported because it's just, I mean, this is something that I think comes up again and again when you're trying to do social affairs reporting. It's trying to write about things like domestic violence, like, you know, violent fathers, which come up in the book. But people just kind of, it's not shocking.
Yeah, there's a way in which we become inured to certain things, and every society does it. So in Britain, I think people are inured to public drunkenness. It's just kind of, you know, it's part of doing business on a market town on a Friday or Saturday night. People can be running around drunk. Whereas there are other countries where that would just not be true. And my wife is American, and quite often, you know, she'll say, well, why did that happen? You know, before you mentioned it, I didn't even think it was weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd said in a speech I'd given, the James Cameron speech, there is this maxim of journalism that dogs bites man is not a story, man bites dog is a story. But sometimes you have to ask yourself, well, why do these dogs keep biting people? And who owns these dogs? And what should we do about all of these dog bites? And this is absolutely one of those things. Seven kids every day. And I lived in America for 12 years as a Guardian correspondent. And it comes up at the end of the news, you know, and it's usually 25, 30 seconds, you know. Last night on 57th and Harper, a young man, so-and-so, was shot dead in a gun violence. Police are still looking for the assailant. Over to the weather. And it's gone. And America is sufficiently segregated that unless you live in those areas, then it might as well take place in a foreign country.
One of the things I think is remarkable about the book is that when you're reading it, you kind of have to pause because it's obviously fairly intense and it makes you angry. And obviously you've written in the past about feeling that one of the reasons why you wanted to come back was your children were getting to the age where police violence. But what gives it its power is you don't write as if you are angry. And I sort of wondered, how did you manage that? Because obviously I assume that you did find it angering.
I did find it enraging, but I also just found it incredibly sad. I mean, and sometimes, you know, peculiarly funny. When you hear the stories sometimes, I have a 9-year-old or a 3-year-old, and you hear of, you know, Jaden playing, I think him and his friend played helicopters, and they had a umbrella, and they would he invented this game. He'd jump off a table and then, you know, do a Mary Poppins, and, you know, it kind of makes you smile. And that all of them, most of them, you go through their Facebook pages or their Twitter, or you speak to their parents, and you think, yeah, I kind of, you know, I know that kid, or, I could know that kid. And so I guess mostly what I was trying to do throughout was give a sense of who, we know how they died, so how did they live, who are these kids, and that anger can quite often just get in the way. Which is why at the end I talk about, you know, I said this kind of just makes me want to howl at the moon. And some of the stuff it wants, you know, I want to shout at the kids like I shout at my kids, like, don't do that, you know. For some of these kids, there are signs, you know. A couple of weeks before he dies, Justin, he's the last boy to die that day, changes his profile page to a kind of high caliber bullets. And you're like, please just stop and think. But of course they do that not in the knowledge, you know, not thinking that they're going to die in a couple of weeks. And, but mostly it makes you want to howl at the moon. And a bit that made me angry was actually when you drew back and then you would see the what passes for a gun debate play out on, on the telly in the legislature, and think, you are going to do nothing about this, are you? You are going to do nothing about this. It's going to be another day. There's going to be more dead kids. And, you know, it feels so clear that they're failing, these kids.
So you went out to the US, was it 12 years ago? Well,
2003.
Yeah, and then you came back in 2015. You went out under a Republican president and came back under a Democrat. I mean, one of the things that I find most striking about this is, you know, I think Obama's extraordinary Amazing Grace rendition was a really beautiful moment. But the thing I get mostly is just from him is just an intense kind of, here I am again. And actually, how much has the conversation moved on in that time you were in America?
See, I think it's moved on quite a bit in the last 3.5 years. I think what happened, I went to see Obama speak in Florida. And it happened to be, I thought I was going to see a campaign speech, and it happened to be the morning after the Aurora shooting, when the guy goes into the cinema in Colorado and shoots him. And Obama arrived, and he says, you know, now's not a day for politics, and, you know, it's all, you know, bow our heads. And he says what presidents had said up until that point, and that enraged me. It was in the run-up to the election, and I thought, no, this is about politics, actually. And if this isn't the time for politics, when is it? Mm. Not to dance on anybody's grave, but these people have died and something could have been done. When Newtown happens, it's just after the election. It's in between the election and the inauguration. And you can see that he'd been biting his lip and that he says, I've had enough. And I think his tears were genuine. And he's like, we have to stop doing this to ourselves. And that was like him clutching the third rail. Mm. You know, Bill Clinton said, he thinks that he lost in 1994, the big Newt Gingrich contract with America, that he lost that because of the crime bill, which had gun control legislation in it, and that the NRA just came for him. And he thinks that's why Al Gore lost, too, in 2000. Not why he lost in 94, but why Al Gore lost in 2000. And since then, Democrats have just said, we're just not touching this. Mm. There's nothing in it for us. And so for Obama to do that and then to keep doing it has meant that it's now on the agenda, which means it's no longer haram. We can talk about it. And Hillary has talked about it. And she stood with, you know, the mothers of the deceased and so on. And so now it's an issue. And so even though they didn't get any legislation last time, that was after X years of silence. But now it's re-entered the public sphere as something that America has to talk about. And that's Obama's contribution.
I think it's been extraordinary how it's become part of pop culture as well. I think if you look at some of the stuff like Beyonce's Lemonade, which again has, you know, mothers holding up pictures, it is kind of just, it's sort of seeped into the cultural conversation as well as the political one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's that area of America's soft power that really goes against it, that kind of there are a range of ways in which people around the world think, oh, America, that's a place I would like to be. But the gun thing, I found a bit like the healthcare thing, is something that most people in the Western world just don't understand. Why would you want that? Why would you not fix that? And that the argument about the Second Amendment is just inadequate. It's kind of, it's a fundamentalist argument. It's an appeal to a text in the same way that, you know, all fundamentalists appeal to texts. And it's a pretty shaky appeal to a text at that, but that, I mean, I've made a conscious decision in the book not to go into that unless somebody raised it, and they didn't raise it. So there was an interesting thing right at the end when I was kind of doing the final edit, where I had these three paragraphs or four paragraphs about the Second Amendment, and I was thinking, I actually said to my editor in America, is it possible to write a book about gun death in America and not have the Second Amendment in it? Or should I just find a place for it? And we kicked it around and thought it was, you know, worth a mention. But wherever I put it, it seemed kind of intrusive. And it seemed intrusive because while it's relevant in terms of explaining the obstacles, it's not relevant in terms of explaining the deaths.
Mm, that's interesting.
So I kind of want to bring up what you said earlier, that I went straight from reading The Black Presidency to reading your book. And one of the... It's been more difficult for Obama in some ways to talk about race without frightening white America.
Mm.
So in an odd way, Hillary's had this space to, in some ways, talk more about those issues. But do you worry then... It almost, you know, my fear with her is, and it's almost as if she's going to upset white America by being too in their faces, as it were. Do you think that is a legitimate fear?
I doubt she can upset white America as much as Obama upset white America just by being. And also, interestingly, not just being black, but being the son of a lapsed Muslim at a time when they were at war with predominantly Muslim countries, being the son of an immigrant at a time of, you know, xenophobic anxiety, being this kind of cosmopolitan citizen and that. Whereas Hillary can claim middle of the nation, middle of the century, middle America, this, you know, but I think she has a tin ear sometimes for this stuff. But it's also important to remember, because of the way these things are racialized, that, for example, most of the people who were shot dead by police are white. Narrowly, most of the kids who are shot dead each day are white. I mean, it's not reflected in this book, but you pick a different day and you get different kids. And so there is a section of white America, if one can change this, the nature of the conversation. And a different example would be poverty, where poverty has been, and food stamps, has been so racialized that you think it's some kind of affirmative action program for kind of feeding black people, whereas most of the people who use food stamps are white. But once these things are racialized, then they can look like a special racial gift or a particular racial grievance. And so I think the challenge for Obama or Hillary is to place an issue like this in the sphere of kind of public safety, parenting, raising your kids, childhood, as opposed to things that happen to black people in poor places, because it's kind of, you know, because it's not.
Mm.
And one of the things I try, if there's a central desire in a book, is to enable empathy with these kids, all of whom could be dismissed, as I said earlier, for being something. But actually, for most people who know or have a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid in the house, they're entirely recognisable as young people.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You previously wrote a book on identity, which I'm a really big fan of. And I think it's a really interesting... We started to... I mean, it comes actually back to the maybe America's racial politics again, is that... We're used to talking about identity politics as something discrete from politics, and I wonder how you feel about that trend for identity in politics. Where is it driving politics, that increased emphasis on identity?
In a range of places, I guess. I mean, some of it is increasingly reactionary. And that's always the risk with identity, is that it turns into a kind of fundamentalism where it's the place where people finish. I'm black and therefore I'm white and therefore I'm female and therefore. And so that shuts the conversation down and it denies any opportunity for empathy or solidarity or coalition building or any of that. And it kind of cuts us off from our common humanity, which I think, if we look at some of the conversations around Brexit, around immigration, around kind of Trumpism, if he deserves an ism, you know, it kind of speaks to a kind of identity politics that previously hadn't been considered as such. Nationalism, kind of fundamentalist white racism. On the other hand, there are other kinds of identity politics that, I kind of find encouraging. I think that the way young women are reclaiming a kind of feminism is actually kind of quite inspiring. And where would gay marriage be without a form of identity politics? I mean, I'm 47, and in the time that I've been politically conscious, gay lifestyle or perception, gay politics, or the place of kind of gay politics in kind of national politics has been utterly transformed. I was at a school in Hackney, looking at schools with my son, and in the maths class, not the sociology class or the religion, there was this poster that just said, "Some people are gay, get over it." And you just think that in a generation.
Yeah. No, I thought that last night. I was in Soho and just a couple of guys walked past me holding hands. And I thought, I'm nearly 33. And that just in my youth was just not a thing that people did. Just knew that was, no one would do that. They would be too concerned about getting beaten up. And I'm sure there are still places where that's very true. But the spots where that isn't true are getting bigger and bigger, I hope.
Yeah. And the scope for conversation of kind of what one would assume when I kind of when I'm talking to my son or even my daughter who's 3, I have to watch my language in ways that I ways which would have been unthinkable when I was their age.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. One quick final question. You interviewed Jeremy Corbyn.
I did.
Where would you like to make a wild prediction for the Labour's next year? It had a pretty wild year, this last one. But where do you see it going?
I fear it will get worse before it gets better. I hope that there is a coming to the senses that this man isn't going anywhere. And that parliamentary party's not going anywhere. And they both represent something quite important.
Mm.
So best work it out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost down to kind of marriage counselling at this stage. But that clearly, Corbyn did not have a plan for winning.
Mm.
And clearly nobody else did either. And then there's been a year now. And seems likely that he will win again, and therefore best everybody make plans for how we all make the most of that, because whining about it is not really a viable solution, and crowing about it is not really a viable solution, and I don't think it's beyond the wit of man or woman to work out some way in which they can work together on a limited set of things. That's what I hope happens.
It's good. It's good to have some optimism in this podcast, which can often be a doom factory. But thank you so much for spending the time. And the book is Another Day in the Death of America. And thank you, Gary Young.
Thanks for having me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by Helen Lewis and me, Stephen Bush, and produced by India Bork. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.